The Spoken Word Library presents The Politics of Cancer Therapy, a lecture by G. Edward Griffin. Mr. Griffin is well known because of his unique talent for researching obscure and difficult topics and then presenting them in clear, concise terms that all can understand. He is a graduate of the University of Michigan, where he majored in speech and communication. He has spent most of his life in various aspects of radio, TV, and motion picture production. Currently, he is president of a publishing and audiovisual production company in Southern California. Mr. Griffin is the author of numerous documentary books and films on diversified and controversial topics. One of these is World Without Cancer, the story of vitamin B17. It is upon part two of that book that this lecture is based. And so, the Spoken Word Library now presents G. Edward Griffin speaking on the politics of cancer therapy.
Why, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. It was the summer of 1971 that I first heard the word Laetril. I was spending a little vacation time with a good friend of mine, Dr. John Richardson from the San Francisco area. We were up in the beautiful Pacific Northwest trying to get away from the tensions and frustrations and worries of everyday life in the big city, enjoying the trees and the babbling brooks and all that sort of thing. And Dr. Richardson, who was a very intense man, took with him not a fishing kit or a hunting kit, but a briefcase. And his briefcase was loaded with papers and documents and books, including an article that he had written, a potential article that he had hoped would be worthy of magazine publication. And he asked me to read it and to tell him what I honestly thought about it. And I read the article, and I thought to myself, good grief, what is Dr. John into now? Because he was claiming in this article that he had stumbled across a revolutionary concept of cancer and a means of treating cancer, that he had approached it very cautiously in the beginning. After all, he was an orthodox physician, had a good practice in San Francisco, and had wondered if this were really true, why hadn't he heard about it through the normal medical channels. He had approached it cautiously. He had experimented with it, first on some animals. He had begun to experiment on some cancer patients who were terminal. And lo and behold, it worked. And some of these patients came back from the edge of the grave. And so he pursued it. He learned more about it. He learned about the mechanism. He learned of the theoretical base behind it. And he was convinced at that time, 1971, that he had discovered, not discovered, but stumbled across, as I say, a true control for cancer. But the interesting part of it was, according to this magazine article that he had written, that he was being opposed in this by other members of the medical profession. He was being opposed by the American Medical Association, by the American Cancer Society, by doctors on the staff of the hospital where he practiced, and so forth. He was being called a quack. And pressures were being brought against him to abandon this very fruitful area of experimentation and research and therapy. And I remember turning to Dr. John at that time, and I said, now, wait a minute, John. You mean to tell me that people are actually trying to hold back a control for cancer? And he said, well, that's the way it seems to me. And I said, no, that can't be true. I can't buy that. Who are they, John? Who are they that are trying to hold back a control for cancer? Who would be so heartless, so bloodthirsty, if you will, so cruel to condemn to suffering and death untold millions of people when right at their fingertips there was a control for cancer? Well, I didn't know it at the time, but with the asking of that question, I had already started on what later turned out to be about a 3-year research project. My curiosity had been aroused, and I was on the trail of what turned out to be one of the most fascinating stories of the 20th century. A story in which the science of cancer therapy isn't nearly as complicated as the politics of cancer therapy. Now, ladies and gentlemen, it is not my intent here this evening to discuss or to present the scientific aspect of this subject. The limitations of time are just too strict for that. As a matter of fact, I'm probably going to be stretching my limit as it is. I'm just going to be talking about the politics. Those of you who have an interest in the scientific question, let me just summarize it briefly by saying that cancer is a deficiency disease, like scurvy, pellagra, pernicious anemia. It's not caused by some virus or mysterious toxin or bacterium. It's caused by the lack of something, by the lack of an essential element, food compound, in our daily diet. And the ultimate solution to cancer is very simple, just to restore this substance to our daily intake. I say restore it because it used to be there before man became modernized and his taste buds began to seek out sweet foods and prepared foods, and the economy of the mass food industry has added a lot of things and taken out of a lot of things and so forth. But you find that cancer is predominantly a disease of civilization. The more primitive peoples in the world, the peoples who eat foods that are more raw, more basic, more bitter to our taste, do not have cancer. And as a matter of fact, if you allow your curiosity to run away with you and you started exploring that avenue, you discover that of all of the cultures around the world, such as the Hunzikuts in northwest Pakistan, the Abkhazians in the Black Sea, the Hopi, the Navajo Indians, the Eskimos, the Aboriginal Eskimos, and so forth, of all of those cultures in the world where cancer is unheard of or almost unheard of, and if you examine the native foods that these people eat, you find that their diet is roughly 200 times more rich in this vitamin factor than is the diet which you had this evening and which you have been eating most of your life. When is the last time you ate an apple seed? We've been told that apple seeds are to be avoided because they're dangerous or something like that. Apple seeds, among many other seeds, are very rich in vitamin B17. It's a fantastic story, and I just urge you, if you are interested, to get hold of the book on the subject, read up on it. But turning to the question of the politics, this is where the controversy really is. So as I say, my intention here is, to the best of my ability and in the time allotted to me, to answer that very provocative question, who are they, John? Now, I have to warn you further that what I'm about to say this evening will appear at first to be far removed from the subject of cancer or cancer therapy. But it isn't. I hope you'll see it all tie up in the end. We're going to talk about world history. We're going to talk about World War II. We're going to talk about the Nazis. We're going to talk about cartels and industry and that sort of thing. It is absolutely essential to have this information to understand who are they. Now, the information that follows is taken primarily from government hearings. Most of them are right there in the library today. Hearings that took place between the years 1928 and 1946. Hearings on such subjects as Nazi propaganda, the munitions industry, cartels, national defense, patents, lobbies, banking and currency, and especially the court records from the Nuremberg trials. It's a very interesting source of information. So what I'm saying is that the information is not widely known, and yet there's nothing mysterious about it. It is simply a matter of the public record for anyone to read if they want to simply take the time to dig it out. And this is the story. There came into being, shortly after World War I, in Germany, a cartel. It was known then and is still known today as IG Farben. IG Farben. IG stands for Interessengemeinschaft, which I'm told in German means community of interest, or in plain English, a grouping or a cartel. Interessengemeinschaft, community of interest, community of corporate interest, a cartel. Farben is the German word for dyes or dyestuffs. It is only of historical interest because when the cartel first came into being It was a grouping of chemical companies that did one thing, and that was to make dyestuffs. But that has long since ceased to be its primary identity. It has grown and expanded so that through the years it has become a cartel of all forms of commercial chemicals, including munitions and drugs. I.G. Farben. It's necessary to define a cartel very briefly. A cartel simply is what you might call an international monopoly. It is a monopoly that crosses national boundaries. It is a grouping of corporate interests that come together and by contract agree with each other not to compete in various areas where they might otherwise compete. Now, at one end of the spectrum, the least harmful of these contracts, these cartel agreements, would be something on patents and agreements where they would standardize their tools. Everybody would get the same size nut and bolt. Something like this would be very harmless. And that would be a cartel agreement. They would agree not to compete on standards like that. You would say generally that that was a very advantageous thing. But most of the cartel agreements are not innocuous like that. Most of them deal with forms of competition that would otherwise result in reducing a price. They agree not to compete on price. They agree, for instance, not to compete in markets, geographical markets. They'll say, well, you can have South America, I get North America, and this guy over here gets Asia, and so forth. They agree not to compete on product. You can produce all of this kind of a drug, the anesthetics, and we'll stay with the antibiotics. Oh, you produce tractors, we produce automobiles. You produce military equipment, we produce equipment for peacetime use. So we don't get in each other's way. And by layering these agreements, one on top of each other, gradually these corporate entities, which are competitors, come closer and closer together. And the areas of competition become narrower and narrower until finally the end of this process is a conglomerate of giant corporations which for all practical purposes are one. And the economy of the world has been moving in that direction for many, many years. It's not complete yet, but this is one of the goals of international corporations. The end result will be a one world, if you will, a one world corporation. Portions of this corporation will be owned by different people. And on the surface, there will be competition for reputation, even like today in this country we see a great deal of competition, let's say, in the drug industry, but it's all on name, brand name. There's no price competition, you can be sure. And the companies stay pretty much within their own agreed-upon spheres of manufacturing. They stay in a certain kind of a chemical manufacturing, and they do not get out of that field. And the advertising is simply what you call institutional advertising, the good old name Bayer. That's the only thing they're competing on is name. And even that someday may disappear as far as competition is concerned. So these are the cartels. Now the I.G. Farben cartel, or just commonly called I.G., existed in 93 countries on all continents. And we know a lot of information about I.G. because at the end of World War II, the Allied forces moved in and took over the building, which was the headquarters of I.G. Farben. It was intact. And although many of the files had been destroyed, many of them were not, and the records were there. And so we know that they existed in 93 countries on all continents, and if you were to just read a list of the corporations in this world that had interlocking cartel agreements with IG, it would take you hours just to read the names, one after the other. There were, in fact, over 2,000 companies. IG dominated all of German industry. It dominated most of European industry. And it dominated much of the industry in the United States of America. I'd like to read to you a very partial list of those firms in the United States which were part of the IG Farben interlock. They include Abbott Laboratories, Alcoa, Anaconda, Atlantic Oil, Bell & Howe, the Borden Company, the Carnation Company, Dow Chemical, DuPont, Eastman Kodak, Firestone Rubber, Ford Motor, General Drug Company, General Electric, General Mills, General Motors, General Tire, Glidden Paint, Goodyear Rubber, Gulf Oil, the Kellogg Company, Monsanto Chemical, National Lead, Nestle's, Owl Drug Company, Park Davis & Company, Pet Milk, Pittsburgh Glass, Procter & Gamble, Pure Oil, Remington Arms, Richfield Oil, Shell Oil, Saucony Oil, Standard Oil, Texaco, Union Oil, U.S. Rubber, and hundreds more. Now, those are ones that just had, better known ones, that just had interlocking cartel agreements of one kind or another. That's not too bad, you might think. Those companies which were owned outright by IG Farben, totally owned, or companies in which the controlling interest was held. Here are some of the companies that fall into that category. The Bayer Company. By the way, Professor Bayer was one of the founders of IG Farben. The Bayer Company, Lederle Laboratories, American IG Chemical Corporation, Sterling Drug Company, Winthrop Chemical, Metz Laboratories, Hoffman LaRoche Laboratories, the J.T. Baker Chemical Company, Whitehall Laboratories, Frederick Stearns & Company, the Nyall Company, Dern & Mitchell Laboratories, Chef Boyardee, Breck Incorporated, Hyden Antibiotics, McGregor Instrument Company, Antrol Laboratories, Cardinal Laboratories, Van Ness Laboratories, the William S. Merrill Company, Jensen Salisbury Laboratories, Lesser Laboratories, Taylor Chemical, the Ozolid Corporation, Alba Pharmaceutical, Bristol Myers, Drug Incorporated, Vagex Incorporated, Squibb and Sons Pharmaceutical, and scores of others. I repeat, these were companies which were totally owned or controlled completely by IG Farben. Now, after World War I, the defeat of Germany in World War I, the German industrialists were very concerned over the fact that they did not have an independent source of petroleum inside Germany. They felt, perhaps rightly, that one of the reasons they lost World War I was because they literally ran out of gas. And so they set the top chemists at Farben, IG Farben, to work. The task was to figure out a way to produce gasoline out of something that was in abundance inside Germany. And of course, there's plenty of coal inside Germany. And they did. They finally perfected something which was known then as the hydrogenation process. After this was perfected, they sent an invitation to the United States, to Standard Oil of New Jersey, the Rockefeller Empire, and they invited Standard to send over to the Baldish plant in Germany, Farben's Baldish plant, someone to come see what they had done, an inspector, an observer. And they sent a man by the name of Frank Howard, who was vice president of Standard Oil and in charge of all overseas operations. And Frank Howard went over there, probably somewhat skeptically about what he was going to find. And they toured him around the plant, showed him their hydrogenation process, and Howard ran back to his hotel and sent a letter to Mr. Walter Teagle, who was the president of Standard Oil. And here, in part, is what that letter said. This was March of 1926. Based upon my observations and discussions today, I think that this matter is the most important which has ever faced our company. The Baldish can make high-grade motor oil fuel from lignite and other low-quality coals in amounts up to one-half the weight of the coal. This means absolutely the independence of Europe on the matter of gasoline supply. Straight price competition is all that is left. And you could almost see the tears streaming down his cheek as he thought about price competition. Good heavens, this is not what monopolists want. Price competition is the last thing they want. So that's why he was concerned. Straight price competition is all that is left, fellas. We've got to do something. He said, I shall not attempt to cover any details, but I think this will be evidence of my state of mind. That was March of 1926. You might keep that in mind the next time somebody is giving you the propaganda about a gasoline shortage and no way to get gasoline. Since 1926, they've been able to make it out of coal. As a matter of fact, the German war machine in World War II was run largely on gasoline that was extracted and produced from coal. Well, all right, so what did Standard Oil do about this? Why did IG Farben invite Standard Oil to see this. I think, my golly, they'd just keep that a big secret, wouldn't they? No, of course not. They're not competitors. They don't want to compete. Their objective was not to go out in the field and compete with price or a better quality product. Their objective was to invite Standard Oil to join with them in a cartel agreement so they wouldn't have to compete. And so in order to come up with a good cartel agreement which would be beneficial to IG Farben, Farben had to show its strength. To give Standard Oil a peek at their cards so they would negotiate. And negotiate they did. Negotiations went on for 3 years. And at the end of that negotiation, Standard Oil and IG Farben were married. And I use that phrase, that word, married, because this is the word that Mr. Howard used to describe it. That describes the intensity of the cartel agreement that brought these two cartels together. The cartel agreement was signed on November 9, 1929, and it contained three basic provisions. One, Standard Oil received one-half ownership of all of the rights to the hydrogenation process everywhere in the world, except Germany. Two, in return, IG Farben received 456,000 shares of Standard Oil stock, which was valued in 1929 at over $30 million. You can imagine what its value would be today. And the third provision was that both parties agreed not to compete with each other evermore in their respective fields. In other words, they agreed that in the future, that if Standard Oil ever wished to go into the field of drugs or chemicals in general, it would do so jointly with IG Farben. And Farben agreed that if ever they wanted to go into the field of petroleum or petroleum products, byproducts, they would do so jointly with Standard Oil, so they wouldn't have to compete. And they have lived up to that agreement, ladies and gentlemen, through a war, and right up to the very present. I'm going to digress even further now and tell you something which may come as a surprise. I know it came as one terrific surprise to me when I started digging into the records. IG Farben, which is a group I had never heard of until a few years ago, IG Farben was the dominant force behind Adolf Hitler. Farben created Hitler out of nothing. Farben picked Hitler out of the gutter, so to speak, financed him, promoted him, and pushed him, and made him the head of Germany. At the low point in Hitler's career, he was down and out. He had no followers. He had no money. It was a conscious decision made at the highest levels inside Farben to put untold amounts of money behind Adolf Hitler and make him Chancellor of Germany. And they did. It was just a matter of spending enough money to do so. And also putting pressure to bear on the newspapers inside Germany, which were beholden to IG Farben. And so the editorial tone of all of these newspapers, that is why you find that most of the big businessmen, most of the big cartelists are indeed socialists or collectivists. Fair trade laws are just one example. Consider the rash of recent promulgations by the Food and Drug Administration, supposedly to protect the consumer from all of these dangerous health foods. These dangerous, dangerous health foods. People by the thousands every year are dying of chemical poisoning from drugs of one kind or another, many of them dying in hospitals because of overdoses of some kind of a drug. But yet the FDA is out warning you against the health food nuts. Why are these laws being promulgated? It's because the giant food industry is trying to put down competition, that's all. Use the government to enforce a cartel agreement and to destroy one's competition. We have such things as anti-quackery laws. Now, that sounds very good. That's on behalf of the people. We certainly don't want quacks running around. And so we have anti-quackery laws. And the net effect of an anti-quackery law is to destroy those physicians who practice drugless medicine. See, the definitions built into an anti-quackery law are that if you are a physician and you don't use drugs, you are a quack. And who do you suppose is behind that one? So we have to redefine a few terms. Fascism is not something that is dead and long gone that lived for a brief period in Nazi Germany. And I mean this without any exaggeration. The spirit of Adolf Hitler is alive and well in the United States of America today. Now, as the Nazis prepared for war, they knew that there was going to be trouble in the United States because of their obvious German holdings. All those companies I mentioned to you before, they were commonly known as German holdings. All listed in the library in Standard & Poor's. You could read the list of the board of directors, and they all had German names. We went back to the old issues of Standard & Poor's and checked them all out. You can't pronounce half of them, at least I can't. And so as they prepared for war, they knew that something had to be done. Otherwise, the United States government undoubtedly would, as they did in World War I, step in and take over these companies because they were owned by aliens in time of war. And so they started to camouflage their holdings. They did this through many ways, through, first of all, Americanizing the names of the men who were on the board of directors. We got rid of all the names like Schmitz and replaced them with names like Walter Teagle, who was the president of Standard Oil, and Edsel Ford. And names like that began to show up on the board of directors of the major IG Farben companies. And then also they camouflaged it through a maze of corporate street names, you know, names that are really fictitious names. They used fictitious stockholders, or what we call dummy stockholders, and numbered Swiss accounts, and all of this sort of thing, until finally the whole process culminated in what appeared to be, on the surface, a giant Swiss company, a holding company known as IG Chemie. Now, the Securities and Exchange Commission investigated this whole matter in 1938. And during this investigation, they invited Mr. Teagle, who, as I've said several times, is the president of Standard Oil, to the witness stand. And they asked him, by the way, Mr. Teagle was also on the board of directors of the American IG. All right. So they asked Mr. Teagle a few questions. Did he know who owned American IG, the company which he served on the board of directors? And his answer was, no, he didn't know. They said, well, Mr. Teagle, do you know how many shares of American IG are owned by IG Chemie in Switzerland? He didn't know that either. And they said, finally, well, Mr. Teagle, we notice here on the record that there are 500,000 shares, 500,000 shares of American IG that are issued in your name. Do you own those? He said, no. Oh, you don't own those shares. Well, then who does? He said, I don't know. Can you imagine the gall of a man saying, I don't know? Well, they couldn't force him to answer. It was later shown, though, in further investigations, that he did know exactly who owned those shares. It was proved that Mr. Teagle was acting as an agent of the Rockefeller interests, and he was holding those shares on behalf of the Rockefeller family. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the reason for my going into all of this background is simply this. If you were to go to Washington today and go to the Securities and Exchange Commission and get a list of all of the drug companies operating in the United States and start looking up a list of stockholders to find out who owns them, you will not find the name Rockefeller or Standard Oil or any of the obvious Rockefeller holdings. And you might conclude, therefore, that Rockefeller has nothing to do with the drug industry in America, and you would be wrong. It was a conscious plan dating right back to the original marriage contract between Farben and Standard Oil that Rockefeller would be a dominant force in the field of drugs, but that he would stay in the background and keep it concealed. And this was especially important during time of war, when the Rockefeller interests had to pose as fiercely patriotic enterprises. If it were known then that he was, in fact, a substantial partner with German firms which were actively producing war goods to destroy American lives, it just wouldn't go over too well with the people at the gas pumps. And so it's been a brilliant job of camouflage, and it stays that way today. But the fact remains, when you dig into this history, that the Rockefeller interests are clearly the most dominant force in the field of the drug cartel in America today. Now, the mechanism for the link-up between the Rockefeller IG cartel and the politics of cancer therapy, we're going to take a step closer to that now. That link-up comes when we go back and examine the tax-exempt foundations. Now, these foundations were pioneered by Rockefeller and Carnegie for three purposes. One, to improve their public image, make them look like good guys giving away lots of money to worthy causes. Two, to preserve their vast family fortunes from inheritance taxes. Turn it over to a tax-exempt foundation completely controlled by the family, but technically not in their name. So as long as you can control your money and spend it in any way you wish, who cares whether it's technically in your name or not? Use is the important thing. And so it preserved their fortunes from inheritance tax when everybody else had to pay that inheritance tax. And thirdly, it was very, very useful for financing commercially or ideologically profitable ventures with tax-exempt dollars under the guise of philanthropy. Now, one such profitable venture is the field of cancer research. If you are a firm producing drugs, and you give $1 million to Stanford University or some other research center in the field of cancer research, I would suspect that you'd see to it that your research money was spent in the field of drug research. As a matter of fact, that's where all of that, or most of that research money is spent. Because it comes from the drug interests, it is spent in drug research. The end product of that research is that every year a couple of new drugs are invented or concocted. They're very exotic, very toxic, and very expensive. They're passed down through the grapevine, and the doctors have them in their kit, and they're sold. You pay for them. You buy them. And the $1 million invested in drug research then comes back 2 or 3 years later with $2 or $3 million with it. And they've made a cool profit on the transaction. This is what old John D. Rockefeller used to call efficiency in philanthropy. This is his phrase. Efficiency in philanthropy. Never give it away unless it's going to come back with another dollar with it. Now, the guy that masterminded this efficiency in philanthropy was an interesting person by the name of Reverend Fred Gates. I don't know how reverend he was. He sort of abandoned his ministerial profession very early in the game. He used it more or less as a cover to collect money. He was a great fundraiser in the early days. And he attracted the attention of George Pillsbury of the Pillsbury Flower fame. Pillsbury had a similar problem to John D. Rockefeller. He had a bad reputation. And Fred Gates devised what is called the Pillsbury formula. So that, well, by the way, the Pillsbury formula in this sense is not a formula for flour. It's a formula for bread, if you know what I mean. Here's how they made the bread. See, Pillsbury was giving away money, which was all right. That improved his image. $1 million, he could well afford it, get his name on the stonework of a new hospital or a school or a library. But Fred Gates said, look, George, this is stupid. Why give away $1 million? Here's what I propose. You give away $500,000. You put it up as what we will call it matching funds on the stipulation that the hospital or the school or whatever the object of your philanthropy is will go out and raise the other half. Get the community involved. There'll be a big fundraising drive. Your name will be attached to the fundraising drive. You will be the big hero. You've put up half the money. If only the rest of the people will come up with the other half. And so you'll get businessmen and housewives and everybody else around digging in their pockets and putting in their dollar and their $10 and their $100, and they identify with you, Mr. Pillsbury. And when it's all over, you still get your name on this piece of stone across the archway. You're still a hero, but it only cost you half as much money. And not only that, you've got all of these people in the community identifying with you and thinking you're such a great guy because you and they have both chipped in together. That's the Pillsbury formula. And old John D. Rockefeller saw that, and his eyes began to sparkle, and he invited Mr. Gates to his offices for consultation. And he hired him on the spot. He said, this is the man for me. And as a matter of fact, John D. Rockefeller himself, in writing about Fred Gates, had this to say, and I quote, Rockefeller said, I realized I had met a commercial genius I persuaded Mr. Gates to become a man of business, end quote. And he did. He put Mr. Gates in charge of his philanthropy operations. And one of the first tax-exempt organizations created was called the General Education Board. And it was under the tutelage of Fred Gates. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the purpose of the General Education Board was not, as you might guess, to raise the level of education, but to use education to change society and to mold the attitudes of the unsuspecting public. Now, that may sound like a far-out statement, but consider this. The first publication of the General Education Board appeared in 1904, and in that, here is what Mr. Gates said, and I quote directly. In our dreams, we have limitless resources, and the people yield themselves with perfect docility to our molding hands. The present educational conventions fade from our minds, and unhampered by tradition, we work our own goodwill upon a grateful and responsive rural folk. End quote. Now that's kind of an inside view into the thinking processes of these people who are putting up the money and altering the educational systems of this land for many, many years. The foundation takeover of the medical schools of America occurred fast and very simply done. There were basically just a few steps. The first one was that Rockefeller and Carnegie, acting together, financed the famous Flexner Report of 1910. The Flexner Report was written by Abraham Flexner, and he surveyed all of the medical schools of America and came up with the startling conclusion that they were a mess. And they were, many of them. There were what we call diploma mills. A doctor could get his MD simply by sending in a few dollars or maybe spending a few days or weeks on campus, and he was a doctor, ready to practice medicine. All of them were understaffed, all of them underfinanced, and they needed help. Okay, so far so good. The Flexner Report, financed by Rockefeller and Carnegie. Remember, efficiency in philanthropy. They weren't going to do this until they had a way of getting it back. This dramatized the need for reform. The next step then was to offer reform, to offer money to bring about the necessary reform. And this is where Rockefeller and Carnegie were able to shine. They had lots and lots of money. And so they offered grants to those schools around the country, which naturally would be cooperative with them. Believe me, if somebody showed up and you were the president of a school struggling for money, and a guy by the name of Fred Gates showed up with a black suitcase loaded with $10,000 bills, you sure would listen to what he had to say. And so those schools that accepted the money naturally were amenable to accepting influence from the donors. Now, the donors didn't ask very much. All they asked is to be placed on the board of directors of the schools so they could have a voice in seeing how their money was being spent. That's fair. And anyway, they were respectable gentlemen. Why shouldn't they be on the board? It would be an honor to the university to have men like this on the board of directors or the trustees. So in every one of these schools that accepted the money, there came to be known what was known at that time as the triumvirate. Fred Gates was one, Abraham Flexner was the other, and the third was his brother, Dr. Simon Flexner. They were the three that were sought for all policy decisions at these universities, these medical schools. And they determined the curricula, the textbooks, the whole works. Now, what is the result of that? The result is that those schools that accepted this money and this influence got the money, or able to build buildings, they could hire the best staff, they could get laboratory equipment, and they became, without exception, the prestigious medical schools of America. Those that declined this influence have all but one disappeared because they couldn't compete. That's a very simple conclusion, therefore, that the schools that teach medicine in America today were molded by the hands of men who were beholden to the drug cartel. So the result of all this is fourfold. First of all, the technical quality of medical education in America was upgraded. And that is a blessing. They did a good job on that. Secondly, the staffs and the curricula at these medical schools now lean heavily toward drugs and drug research. Third, the orthodox medical treatment of choice in our land for almost every illness or ailment includes a prescription for one or more drugs. No matter what you go to your doctor for, chances are you walk out with a prescription for something, because that is what he has been trained to do. And interestingly enough, these prescriptions, you do not go out and fill them on the competitive market. This is not a free enterprise proposition. You get them through prescriptions. You do not shop for price. There is no competition. You don't even know what you're getting half the time. It's a beautiful, locked-in system of no competition. And fourth, most physicians will admit this, and by the way, if there are any physicians in the audience, I know I'm probably getting you mad at me, but these are the facts. Most physicians will admit this, that the average physician today knows less about basic nutrition than his wife does, simply because it was never brought out in school. Okay, how do we relate all of this now, bring it all the way back to vitamin B17 and cancer therapy? Does this mean, ladies and gentlemen, that the doctors, your family physician, the doctors you know, doctors at the medical school, does this mean that the men who operate the radiology equipment, the nurses, you know, the whole medical profession, that these people are a part of a giant conspiracy, that they're secret agents of a cartel who are plotting evilly underneath bare light bulbs in basements to hold back a control from cancer? Of course not. Obviously not. I say obviously because, let's face it, these people die of cancer like everybody else. As you know, recently, a Rockefeller died of cancer. Dr. McDonald died of cancer. And he was one of the most outspoken critics of B17. So it's obvious that these people are not consciously holding back a control for cancer. It does mean, however, that the cartel's medical monopoly has created a climate of bias in our educational system in which scientific truth often is sacrificed to vested interest. You see, if the money is coming from drug companies, or indirectly from drug companies, the impetus is in the direction of drug research. Now, that doesn't mean somebody blew the whistle and said, hey, don't research nutrition. It just means that nobody is financing nutrition research. So it is a bias where scientific truth often is obscured by vested interest. It does mean that the medical leaders of this land have been indoctrinated against drugless medicine without their even knowing it, and they too become victims of this bias. It means that whenever anyone moves against the cartel, the whole cartel, with all of its tentacles like an octopus, reflexively moves against the attack. They don't stop to question whether or not there's any merit to the attack. But you are opposing. You are offering competition to the cartel. Therefore, you must be destroyed. And all the tentacles move reflexively against you. And so, ladies and gentlemen, the point I'm trying to make here, when we ask the question, who are they, John? We can name them, we can see them, but we must then ask the question, why do they do it? And the answer to that is not because of a malicious intent to hold back a control for cancer, but simply because these men in politics, in industry, and in medicine are victims of their own bias and an obsession for wealth and power. So what is the solution? A prerequisite to any solution is for us first to realize that cartels and monopolies are not the product of free enterprise, but just the reverse. Monopolies cannot exist without the intervention of government. That is a fact. Government, in other words, is the cause of this problem, not the solution. And any time somebody says, well, we need the FDA to step in here and do something about this, or we want our congressman to do something about this, you're barking up the wrong tree. The best thing you should be asking your congressman to do is to get the government off the back of private research and out of the field of medical practice. Solution, therefore, is to break the cartel's grip over our own government and then to reduce the size and reach of that government so it cannot be used by anyone else as a mechanism for dictatorship. So, ladies and gentlemen, my closing appeal to you is to become active in this crusade. Help to build a grassroots army of opinion, public opinion, that the politicians can no longer ignore. You know, you just might save somebody's life, but the freedom you will save will be yours. Thank you very much.
After hearing this lecture, the serious student and researcher will want to have a personal copy of Mr. Griffin's 592-page book entitled World Without Cancer, The Story of Vitamin B17. In addition, school or civic organizations may wish to rent or purchase the film strip version. Both can be obtained from American Media.
This has been a presentation of the Spoken Word Library, a unique concept in the fields of home entertainment and education. A wide range of pre-recorded programs is offered in such diverse categories as world affairs, health and nutrition, earth history and the origins of man, lifestyles for better living, mysteries to science, true life adventures, and stories just for fun. A free listing will be sent upon request. Write to American Media, Post Office Box 4646, Westlake Village, California 91359. Duplication of these recordings is prohibited.